You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. As well, you can hear these podcasts at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. There are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, which are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 217A by Rudolf Steiner, entitled Youth and the Etheric Heart, Various Addresses and Essays by Rudolf Steiner. This is Part 2, and it is an address entitled Humanizing Academic Life, Address on the Last Day of the First Anthroposophical Higher Education Course, given in Dornach on October 16th, 1920. Translated by Catherine Krieger. As this event draws to a close, it is evident how heavily anthroposophically oriented spiritual science is counting on you. We are counting on you because academia, which has placed us in our current situation, is the only institution capable of counteracting the impending demise of Western civilization. I do not want to spend much time demonstrating that the destructive anti-cultural institutions of modern times are essentially products of scholarly activity, because this connection is already obvious enough. We do not need to talk about it here, but there is something else we should consider. It is also self-evident that the proletariat must be included in any restructuring of society today. In a public lecture in Stuttgart, I once said something that caused considerable offense, both locally and in broader circles. I said that the bourgeoisie is suffering from brain decadence and is therefore absolutely dependent on replacing physical brain work with the spiritualized work of the etheric brain. This is as obvious as anything can possibly be. In contrast, the brains of the upwardly mobile proletariat have not yet become decadent. If we can convert them to brain work, proletarians are still capable of working out of the physical brain. Of course, these statements caused offense in bourgeois circles. But the point nowadays is not to avoid giving offense, but to bring the truth to light. The modern proletariat, however, is genus-faced, to use a rather grotesque expression. How does this two-sided character manifest? On the one hand, proletarians always tend to say, quote, "We don't want to know anything about what you academics are trying to tell us. It's too difficult for us, and we're just not interested." Close quote. On the other hand, these proletarians have been fed exclusively on the waste products of 19th and early 20th century scholarship. Waste products are all they have to work with. We must make every effort to see their situation in this light. It will not be easy to make the results of our serious scholarship accessible to the proletariat. But if we do not allow ourselves to be scared off, if we persist in the social action of winning the proletariat over to intellectual activity, we will be able to introduce them to this healthy element just as surely as they were introduced to Marxism and Bolshevism. We must simply not give up prematurely. We must persist in doing what we have recognized as right. Because this has always been my precept in anthroposophical work, I have never compromised. I am fully aware that my rejection of dilettantism has made enemies, but there was no way around it. If someone felt it worth the effort, it would be very easy to prove that the bulk of our current enemies are people I once rebuffed because of excessive dilettantism. That is what you would find if you looked into the details. Admittedly, that would require some compensation for memory, which is no longer so highly developed, as you realize when you tackle spiritual scientific training. You learn how to assess your enemies, who often appear out of nowhere years later. If you are not afraid to persist in doing what you know to be right, you will also have success with the proletariat. proletarians are simply suffering from an exaggerated feeling of authority. As soon as you get them on their own, you will be able to win them over. At present, the biggest hurdle is convincing these people that their leaders, big and small, are their greatest enemies, parasites, in fact. Once we succeed in convincing them, we will probably be able to interest the proletariat in our healthy scholarship. In fact, they will be an exceptionally good audience. Of course, the proletarian masses will have to be the audience for a long time to come. But now, I want to draw your attention to a different issue. You see, in my years of activity in the anthroposophical movement, I have always attempted to bring anthroposophy together with specialized academic disciplines. But I have always encountered difficulties. Let me give you a few specifics. Many years ago, an expert in the field of Oriental and Assyrian studies became enthusiastic about anthroposophy. It goes without saying that we expected him to make some connection between his field of expertise and his newfound enthusiasm. But he could not bring himself to do it. He could not be persuaded to bridge the gap between these two areas of study. He forged ahead in both fields, but was unable to bridge the gap. Nonetheless, it is absolutely necessary to attempt to find or to build this bridge, and we will find it. It must be possible to gain access to every academic discipline through anthroposophy. In a similar instance, I once knew a very famous professor of botany who was also an ardent theosophist. This man wrote books on botany in addition to writing about theosophy. He belonged to the Theosophical Society, not the Anthroposophical Society, so he wrote about theosophy after the manner of Annie Besant. As soon as he closed his books on theosophy, he was a botanist through and through. But when he lectured or wrote about theosophy, he was the consummate theosophist. And no one could tell that he was also a botanist. I sometimes brought up the subject of botany as a prelude to bridging the gap, but he was actively averse to talking about it with me. You see, this, quote, double-entry bookkeeping, close quote, as I always call it, is a consequence of the culture of a century ago. People want to write about everything related to their professional life in professional journals and everything related to feeling to the, in quotes, inner person in the Sunday supplements to the newspaper. Politics falls somewhere in between. In keeping with the current version of the threefold ordering of society, they want to get their politics from the newspaper itself. It is most important to see through these things. In a certain sense, though the issue will not always be so cut and dried, you yourselves may be best qualified to find the bridge. As early as the turn of the 18th to the 19th century, poor Hölderlin put it very beautifully. He said that when he looked around at his Germany, he saw civil servants everywhere, along with factory owners, cabinet makers, and tailors, but no human beings. He saw scholars, artists, teachers, and so forth, but no human beings. Today we might say that this is especially true of the academic professions. There are no human beings there. We have academic disciplines and scholars drifting around us as if they were real, but to the extent that we feel human, we live almost entirely outside our academic knowledge. Just think about what people do today when they sum up all their scholarly knowledge to write a paper or apply for promotion to a professorship. What do? They cannot just sit down and write about whatever flows out of their souls, because there is no place for that in an academic work. They would soon be accused of writing off the cuff, and you are not allowed to write off the cuff. To write your dissertation, you must study books you would not bother opening otherwise. Even for your dissertation, you might simply look for quotations and note the pages instead of actually reading the books. Your relationship to your subject is supposed to remain as superficial as possible. You are not supposed to develop an intimate relationship to it. When people engaged in this type of work get together after hours, Well, I could tell you stories about strange encounters I had in Weimar while working in the Goethe and Schiller archives. As soon as anyone mentioned anything related to Goethe or any scholarly subject whatsoever, someone would say, quote, "Here we go again, talking shop. Cut it out." Close quote. The whole purpose of getting together seemed to be to avoid getting a reputation for talking shop. This attitude, however, is in large part responsible for our current situation. In the 7 years I spent in Weimar, I found very little difference between nationalities in this respect. When Mr. Thomas, who came from the far west, from an American university, wrote about Goethe's title Faust, his work and thinking were essentially international. There was no way to distinguish them from those of any student of Schmidt or Scherer. The only thing that distinguished him as an American was the fact that he sat cross-legged on the floor to get to the books on the bottom shelf. In all other respects, he did his work just like everyone else. The only exception was a Russian privy counselor. No one was sure what he was researching. Whenever he came into a bar in the evening, people said to each other, quote, "Don't turn around, the privy counselor's here," close quote. People avoided sitting with him because he always started talking about what he knew about Faust. Now, these seemingly trivial incidents are actually more important than we might imagine. If we considered many more such examples, they would explain many gradual developments in academic life. But this is exactly what we want to get away from. We certainly do not want to become pedants or people who talk shop all the time, but we must realize that human beings take precedence over all academic disciplines. As human beings, we must not allow ourselves to be tyrannized by academic knowledge. In our efforts to emancipate cultural activity, we are combating the abstract character of academia as such, and placing human beings first. Our academic knowledge will develop beyond what Bölsche described as immortal knowledge. He proposed a spiritual science of sorts, but he went looking for it in libraries, where the actual spirits are hidden behind paper and printer's ink. Humanizing academic activity is our goal. We must work toward bringing the human being to the fore in so-called objective scholarship, which must be grounded in life and in human beings. Those of us who engage in it must not become dry and shriveled. On the contrary, by, quote, combating abstract existence, close quote, as I call it, we become useful contributors to the very necessary process of counteracting the barbarization of Western civilization. This is what is most essential for those entering academic professions or occupations supported by academic disciplines. It is also why I believe it will be such a great blessing if you form groups in your individual universities and independently tackle themes as we attempt to do in anthroposophical groups, especially in the Waldorf School. I imagine these study circles as something very different from being like a school. We will attempt to bring together different threads from the fabric of the necessities of our time. We will draw from the total context of our culture in suggesting topics. Certain members of our Waldorf School faculty will stay in contact with those who have lectured here and will collaborate with them to discover topics that need to be addressed today. They will then suggest to you, our student members, certain tasks that seem necessary from the perspective of insights available in our circles. What happens next will not be like getting assignments. It will be an attempt to get to the bottom of issues that are especially critical today. There will be real opportunities for scholarly work. But I want to emphasize that establishing little scholarly circles that are, or at least claim to be, working on these topics is not enough. Of course, they must happen. They can and will be very useful. But alongside them, we need a large-scale movement of student groups, a movement that is truly aware that young people simply cannot continue to abide by the intentions of people who come out of older times and old traditions, the people who are now sitting in academic offices, I mentioned that the Social Democrats need to get rid of their leaders. It is equally necessary for young people today to get rid of their old leaders. And that will be more difficult to accomplish than it actually should be. You see, I cannot avoid mentioning the crucial point. Please understand that I am telling you this in complete honesty and sincerity. You can rest assured that it would be easy to advance our anthroposophically oriented spiritual movement if we were free to work only for spirit, and if spirit were all that spurred us on. Meanwhile, we are not the people who are assigning posts, granting degrees, and allowing students to fail their state exams. Other people are doing that. This is an important factor that we certainly do not underestimate. We know very well how much courage and audacity it takes for prospective academicians and intellectual workers to join us and stay with us, because we still have very little to offer. The situation will improve as our individual initiatives really begin to pull their own weight. When the Waldorf School was founded, I commented that its founding was all well and good, but it would be meaningless if we did not open at least 10 additional schools in the next quarter year. Only then would the Waldorf School be truly established. The need is clear, and that is why you must find the courage to ally yourselves in some way with our intentions. But on the other hand, I am thinking in practical terms about how the Waldorf School was founded. Once we are really in a position to emancipate cultural activity, there will be more and more Waldorf schools, and then we will be able to offer our young graduate friends a future. I am not being at all unidealistic when I say this. Until then, reciprocal support is essential. Our work to establish independent schools, up to and including institutions of higher learning, will be successful only if we meet with understanding on the part of students. For that, we need not just small groups, but a large-scale student movement to support our intentions. Since I always pursue practical ideas, not just ideas that one can simply hand down, I have considered the possibility of our schools employing people who tackled their studies as Dr. Stein did. As he tells it, he registered for courses, attended the first few lectures to see what was going on, and then spent the rest of his time studying my lecture cycles and works quoted in them, and managed to complete his academic course of study in that way. Of course, his approach is not universally applicable, because probably only 3/4 of the professors would tolerate it if all their students were like Dr. Stein, showing up only for the first 3 lectures and then taking a hike. This approach is not realistic for the general public, and so I will not recommend it. Nonetheless, I want to suggest to you that the spirit now occupying lecterns in our university lecture halls has no future if it is transferred to elementary and secondary classrooms. During this conference, I told you about the World School Association. I want you to know that I take its founding very seriously. I imagine this association as international in scope, arising out of people's thoughts and feelings about cultural activity. In reality, there are only 2 competing movements in the world today. One is Bolshevism, which is leading the world into a morass. The other is the threefold organizing of the body social. If we can convince the world of this dichotomy, people will be forced to make a choice as soon as they realize that old impulses are going nowhere. Those who want to advance culture in any sensible way must gradually get used to the idea of a threefold social order. If they do not, if they are too lazy to do that, then Bolshevism will inundate Europe and barbarize European culture. Once people understand this, it will be easier to win them over than it is now. In this connection, there are 3 things we really must consider. When we speak to the international community about a project such as our building in Dornach, and the fact that we need money for it, the reaction is, quote, "We mustn't be so petty as to donate money for undertakings based on pure idealism. Money is much too filthy to be used for such an idealistic project." Close quote. In other words, without lengthy preparation, people are not prepared to contribute. Given the current situation in Central Europe, we cannot raise sufficient funds here to complete our building. So we are dependent on other parts of the modern civilized world, where people are tight-fisted and not prepared to donate. In contrast, it is relatively easy to solicit donations for sanatoriums, for example. If you are building a sanatorium, you can get as much money as you want. The middle way is what I am hoping for with the World School Association. That association, if rightly understood, will be able to finance all sorts of cultural facilities. Because people understand schools better than they understand something like our building, we must agitate on behalf of the middle ground. That is why advance preparation or drumming up support for the founding of this World School Association is so important. I believe that the best thing you students could do would be to become enthusiastic and convince everyone you meet of the need for an international World School Association and of the importance of its task, which is to emancipate cultural activity and to finance as many independent schools as possible all over the world. The emancipation of cultural activity must happen on the largest possible scale. We must succeed in liberating ourselves from cultural subjugation, but we can do so only by actively drumming up support for the idea. The tyranny is greater than we think. I myself will initiate the founding of the World School Association here, but this effort must be preceded by mustering support. Nothing can be achieved today by working in groups of a dozen or 15 people. Everything depends on the broadest possible dissemination of the idea that a World School Association must come about. Of course, I realize students do not have very deep pockets, and I am not asking you to donate. That is what other people are there for. But even if you cannot open your wallets, you can open your mouths. If you talk up the World School Association wherever you go, our request will not fall on deaf ears. When we approach people in the near future about founding the association, they will be primed and receptive. This is what has to happen. You see, we have plenty to do. We need nothing more than real courage and an independent view of the world. Why should we not use youthful energies to overcome the obstacles that threaten to bring us to our knees, especially when those obstacles bear the imprint of times past? We cannot allow ourselves to be brought to our knees. We must realize that we are dancing on a razor's edge today, or on a volcano, if you prefer. It is not true that things can continue as they are now. We are facing very, very depressing times, but with courage and energy we will get through them. I believe the spiritual science of anthroposophy can be a support to you or to anyone in this process. In conclusion, let me simply ask you not to be selective or sectarian in your actions. You must work on the largest possible scale. Exclude no one. Include everyone who wants to work with you. The only determining factor should be whether someone honestly wants to work in the same direction in preparing for scholarly vocations that have been so abused. We must be open-minded and welcome anyone who honestly wants to work with us. We must not draw distinctions among individuals. We must allow anyone of good will to work with us. In essence, this is how it has always been in the Anthroposophical Society. We have never asked people to abandon anything they stand for in the world. We simply ask that they accept what comes to them from the Anthroposophical movement. Let me inject a personal note here. You know, I have been repeatedly reproached for my former association with the Theosophical movement, but the reality of the situation is that the Theosophical movement approached me. The Theosophists joined forces with me for a while, until they abandoned what I represented. In my first meeting with them in London, I told them that we were all bringing our gifts to the common altar. There was no question of simply accepting pronouncements from central headquarters. This is how we can work together with the largest number of people. If you work among students in this way, we will indeed be able to forge ahead. The end of part 2.